Before getting into an introduction, which will last about half an hour, I'd like to offer something to Elizabeth Gilbert. Elizabeth Gilbert is particularly in love with Werner Herzog. And so as a little treat, I would like her to see a drawing, a conversation portrait that Flash Rosenberg, our artist in residence, did of Werner Herzog. To introduce it, Flash Rosenberg.
Thank you, Paul. What does it mean to listen to a conversation? I was in the audience and realized that conversations are not just happening up here on the stage, but in each of us as we sit here taking it all in. So how do ideas enter your mind? Specifically, I mean, what's the process? What does it look like to listen? So to find out, I started drawing these live conversations on a big pad of paper in my lap. Then I started videotaping those drawings, then edited them into animated summaries. Excuse me. Because I wanted to show how ideas struck me during the conversations. I want to put the ing back in drawing, which means that it's an active thing that happens. And so the finished drawing is just a draw, but the drawing is something that becomes these animated conversation portraits. And instead of drawing caricatures or court reporting, I mean, these drawings are not even accurate. Instead, they trace what I see in my mind, as if I could photograph a snapshot of concepts using a pen. So here's a conversation portrait of Werner Herzog in conversation with Paul Holdengraver.
Accepting this invitation, Werner. It's wonderful to have you here. One of the interesting clusters of ideas that come up in my mind as you speak is the importance walking has for you. And you have sometimes likened walking to filmmaking and seen a relationship between the two.
I would be careful to call it walking. There's no real expression in English. I would call it traveling on foot and in our minds, to move at a certain pace and seeing things with intimacy and seeing the details and having en route, you have only substantial encounters.
Many people may not know that you make your home Los Angeles.
Los Angeles.
And if I'm not mistaken, you are known to say that Los Angeles is perhaps the only place in America with substance.
Well, I would say, yes, you find it funny, I know that, yes. But Los Angeles is much more than just filmmaking. In the last half century, almost every single important cultural trend and technological trend originated from California, like computers, like free speech movement, like accepting gay and lesbian people as an integral part of society, like, you just name it, on and on and on.
Let's move you backwards now to your very early years. The very first few years you spent in a very small village near Munich.
The remotest place that my mother could find, who got frightened because the house next to us was bombed and where we lived was half destroyed and I was under a huge pile of debris, glass shards and bricks, and I was only 2 weeks old, but unhurt. So she fled into the mountains and we got stuck there. So I grew up without knowing technology. It's strange that I'm making films, and I did not even know that cinema existed until I was 11, when a traveling projectionist arrived at the schoolhouse.
What are your earliest memories of that time?
It was dangerous because we had found a lot of weapons that were dropped and hidden by the last SS men fleeing into the mountains. And at age 4, I was in possession of a submachine gun, a functioning submachine gun. And my brother had a hand grenade. And I tried to shoot a bird, a crow actually, because we were always hungry. So hunger is one of the great reminiscences of that time, 2.5 years of hunger.
Let's get to one of the core subjects of our evening, which is why or is the 20th century a mistake?
Yeah, I doubt very strongly what the 20th century has done to us, to the human race. And I mean not only that we have witnessed the worst cataclysmic wars that the world has seen just in one century, that we had communism and fascism, the Nazis, and all the consequences. It's many, many other things. I do believe that highly technological civilization that we are living right now is not sustainable. Resources are being wasted in a way that is completely and utterly unhealthy and is not sustainable.
But for you, it started, I mean, the mistake, the misguided nature of human beings, if I understand you well, has a very long history. It started when Petrarch went to the Mont Ventoux.
Yes, well, that's one of the sins of civilization. Why do you climb mountains? And I have been with some of the mountain climbers like Reinhold Messner. They always had the feeling, yeah, we have to conquer it, and we have to. They speak in military terms of conquest, which I have abandoned by now, because there's nothing more to conquer. And I think there was a mistake there. It was the end of something mysterious about our planet. Adventure, which, and I cannot stand the term adventure nowadays. I lower my head and charge. It has degenerated in such an obscenity that you can go to the travel agency and book an adventure trip to New Guinea, to the headhunters, to the cannibals. The traveler on foot is virtuous. Tourism is sin, period, as simple as that. We see embarrassments like tree huggers, and they are concerned about the panda bear, and they are concerned about the well-being of salad leaves. But we have overlooked that 6,000 languages still left. But by 2050, only 15% of these languages will survive. I find it most enraging that that people hug whales. Who hugs the last speaker of Inuit language in Alaska? Nobody. Nobody cares about them.
You've spoken about yourself as a good soldier of cinema.
Yes, but that's more like a metaphor of someone who tries to hold out at an outpost that has been abandoned by almost everyone around, and not being afraid and having a sense of duty. I have a sense of duty. But I think there's something, I'm after something much deeper, some sort of a of an ecstasy of truth, something where we step beyond ourselves. Something that happens in religion sometimes, like medieval mystics, an understanding of God in form of ecstasies. Yes, it is possible, and it's possible in music and in poetry and in cinema. And we are not really looking after it, but it's very, very elusive. Truth is extremely elusive.
So Liz, this was for you, but not only for you. You love stories about Werner Herzog, and you tell one yourself, which I'd like to read out. I have a friend who's an Italian filmmaker of great artistic sensibility. After years of struggling to get his films made, he sent an anguished letter to his hero, the brilliant and perhaps half-insane German filmmaker, Werner Herzog. My friend complained about how difficult it is these days to make an independent film, how hard it is to find government arts grants, how the audiences have all been ruined by Hollywood, and how the world has lost its taste, etc., etc. Herzog wrote back a personal letter to my friend that essentially ran along these lines. Quit your complaining. It's not the world's fault that you have wanted to be an artist. It's not the world's job to enjoy the films you make. And it's certainly not the world's obligation to pay for your dreams. Nobody wants to hear it. Steal a camera if you have to, but stop whining and get back to work. I repeat those words back to myself whenever I start to feel resentful, entitled, competitive, or unappreciated with regard to my writing. It's not the world's fault that you want to be an artist. Now get back to work. Always at the end of the day, the important thing is only and always that. Get back to work. This pass for the courageous and the faithful. You must find another reason to work other than the desire for success or recognition. It must come from another place. I would like to now tell you about an upcoming, there's no segue here, an upcoming exhibition we have here on Friday, June 22nd. Visitors to the New York Public Library will get a taste of old New York when the library opens a new major exhibition, Lunch Hour New York City. We have one of the largest collections of cookbooks and menus here at the New York Public Library. The show explores our city's relationship with that most quotidian of meals, lunch, organized in four thematic sections, quick lunch, home lunch, school lunch, and power lunch. The exhibition reveals how the city's pace and people influenced how, where, and what they have eaten over the past 150 years. From kitchen tables to cafeterias, pretzels to chopped salads, lunchtime has morphed along with demographic shifts, economic development, and changing tastes. So I encourage you very much to come to this exhibition, which is opening in exactly 1 month. Fitting. In some way, to have this talk tonight be a foretaste of lunch in 1 month's time. I encourage also all of you to become friends of the New York Public Library and enjoy the upcoming fall season. Let me whet your appetite very quickly by saying that the fall will include Tom Wolfe and Pete Townsend. 1 year ago, nearly to this day, on May 5th, 2011, Elizabeth Gilbert appeared live from the New York Public Library for her swan song to the world of talk, at least for 3 years, she said. She was now going to write a novel. She was going to travel. How surprised I was then when she enthusiastically agreed to come talk about At Home on the Range. Now 3 years, not 3 years later, but 1 year after our conversation, and not at all about her new novel, I don't think. No, but about a book she rediscovered that her great-grandmother wrote. So we're here today to celebrate a book that Liz Gilbert's great-grandmother wrote. John Hodgman, as everyone knows, and as a Gothamist reported, has amassed the complete world knowledge in his trilogy of books. But nowhere in them, they found, is there a recipe for calf's brains with black butter. Hodgman, the Daily Show correspondent, speaks tonight with Eat, Pray, Love author Elizabeth Gilbert about her great-grandmother Margaret Yardley Potter's cookbook At Home on the Range, which has been reprinted for the first time. The cookbook, which Elizabeth Gilbert found unpacking a box of old family books, draws from recipes created in the 19th century. Potter espoused the importance of farmers' markets and ethnic food and derided preservatives and culinary shortcuts. Sales for the book tonight, which Liz Gilbert will sign, she will sign the book of her great-grandmother, benefit the educational non-profit A26 National and Scholar Match. Now, all of you know that for the last 4 or 5 years, I've asked the various guests I invite to give me a biography, a haiku, a tweet, if you prefer, of sorts about who they are. In 7 words, exactly. Well, some of them are 7 words, some of them are 8 words, you'll see. Liz wrote, mother, grandmothers, aunties, everyone cooked, I napped. Then John said, before television, Hodgman imitated Liz Gilbert. Then Liz said, I can't help but add 7 more. Now an entire generation imitates John Hodgman. Please welcome them to the stage.
Hi, Liz.
Hi, John.
Hi, everybody. I'm John. This is Liz. We make appearances together from time to time, and a number of people find this very confusing. There was one event that seemed like the perfect idea when we met at the Apple Store to have a conversation, and about half the audience were computer nerds and comedy nerds, and the other half of the audience was divorced ladies. And they did not get together the way I hoped. It would have been very exciting.
And what seems to be
very what seems to be very natural for us to be together, I think, causes some disjunction in other humans' brains, because the reality is that we, in previous lives, we were and are friends. So long before my life changed dramatically, and Liz's too, I dare say. Liz was a magazine writer and an idol of mine and a friend. And I was worked in book publishing at the time and was trying to figure out how I could lead a life as glamorous as being a magazine writer. At least
glamorous
the way
life.
Well, at least the way you lead it. And you know, Liz is still today one of the greatest writers I have the pleasure to know, and I'm still her student in every way. So thanks,
thank
pal.
You and good night.
Yeah, there
this
you go.
Has been a wonderful evening.
So, hi,
I'm
Liz.
I'm satisfied. Hi, John.
So, congratulations.
Thank you.
You finally didn't write a book.
I didn't
Which
write a
book. Which is this book that you did
this
not write.
This is a book
write.
That I did not write. Although, when I...
Unless this is a massive, exciting literary fraud.
It is.
Like a new J.T. Leroy thing you're pulling
or
off.
Or like Eat, Pray, Love.
Oh, yeah,
I'm
right.
I'm just kidding. That's not...
also what? Found in my great-grandmother's attic, Eat, Pray, Love.
What a big reveal this is turning out to be. This book I had always vaguely and peripherally knew of, and I should have brought the original. I neglected to bring it. I'm sorry. But my great-grandmother published this cookbook in 1947. She was a columnist for Philadelphia newspapers and Delaware newspapers writing about food, and a terrific, natural, lively, vivid writer. And I had sort of known of her existence but chose to completely ignore it. For 20 years, my mom gave me one of the original copies of the book when I was about 23, and I took one look at the back jacket and saw a nice, kindly, old, white-haired lady with cat's eye glasses, and I was like, ah, everybody's mom, grandma, and great-grandma cooked. Pooh! You know, like, wasn't interested in the domestic arts and just sort of cast it away and discovered it again last spring and just thought, I should take a look at what this thing is, and found this extraordinary living person inside that book who was much more Dorothy Parker than Betty Crocker, and just funny and kind of wild and really appealing and warm, and I just thought I have to do something with this. And I did have a thought to write a book about it, but instead I decided it would be more of an homage to her to just bring the cookbook back exactly in her words with a new introduction, and that's what this is.
And maybe to give us a sense of her voice, you might read just a little bit.
Sure.
Because The introduction of the book sets a scene that really dominates the scope of the book itself, in that this is an amazing writer, first of all, and clearly an amazing woman, adept at thinking on her feet as everything falls down around her. But it's also, it starts, she's a young wife and mother, in an age where entertaining was very, very formal. And she talks about one of the first formal dinners she gave with lots of servants and a cook and a menu that was, you know, 15 lines long and includes the obligatory green turtle soup course, which sadly has been abandoned. And a separate line for celery and radishes, this kind of menu, you know what I mean? In the midst of it, it falls apart, and the lights go out, and the babies start wailing, and the guest of honor is confused, and yet somehow it all becomes rescued in a way that I think colors the entire book, which in many ways is as much a memoir as it is a book about how to cook calves' tongues. So if you wouldn't mind reading from just about where it goes horribly wrong, and then I'll just go get a drink, and I'll be back in a minute.
Come back in a half an hour, John.
Sure.
So she's borrowed her mother's butler for this event, and he has gone on a bender. Her sister has arrived and plugged in, this is in the 30s, has plugged in an electrical appliance and blown out all the fuses. The neighbors who were invited came, saw the house was dark, and left. Had to be got. So everything is going wrong. The meringue is collapsing. So we start here. There in the kitchen sat cook, head in hands, amidst unstacked dishes and guttering candles, gazing out of tear-filled eyes at a partially unwrapped meringue. The threatened headache was a grim reality, and the poor creature could barely get upstairs. Bravely trying to keep some remnant of what I still felt was the necessary formality, I was just about to bring the meringue to the table when the guest of honor appeared in the kitchen and, with a heartening pat on my back, bore the icy pyramid to the dining room sideboard where, amidst cheers, he announced himself as the new butler and proceeded to serve dessert and jovially press second and third helpings with all the confidence of a staged Jeeves. Coffee and brandy, still dignified by silver tray and cut glass decanter, were escorted into the living room by my husband, but by that time all formality had vanished, and my guests continued what they maintained was their most enjoyable evening in years by shooting craps on the floor with the light of every remaining candle. When the electric company's lineman arrived at 11:30 to fix a blown main fuse, he was invited to try a few rolls of the dice before he finished the meringue, and he departed for his next call considerably richer. Our important guest really relished his kitchen supper of beer and self-made onion sandwiches, and when later he joined a game of softball in the hall, batting one of the baby's worsted toys with a rubber-tipped plumber's assistant, his dignity and my failure as a formal hostess were completely forgotten, and I realized that elaborate entertaining with inadequate help was neither convincing nor worth the nerve-shattering effort. Since then, I have been shuttled financially and physically between a 12-room house in the suburbs, a 4-room shack in the country, numerous summer cottages, and a small city apartment. An isolated and heatless farm on Maryland's eastern shore was my home during the war years. In all of these abodes, I have found that providing a really heartfelt welcome and simple and plentiful food gives any hostess an advantage over the famous man who built the better mousetrap. A world of friends will beat a path to your door.
It's so lovely. Thank you. It's my copy, so I'll take it back. It's so lovely and poignant. You point out the poignancy of that last paragraph in your introduction, because in many ways this is a celebratory moment where she kind of casts aside an entire entertaining and culinary tradition for something that is more her own, and clearly everyone's getting drunk too, which is more fun for her. For a while, but also it's a bit of a riches to rags story. How she goes from this very big house with all these servants to an unheated farmhouse during the war,
and to worse abodes as well. I mean, her story really is a riches to rags story. Her family was a prominent mainline Philadelphia sort of demi aristocracy that I always forget that my family descended from, because she lost it all. She and her husband, my great-grandfather, who I knew very well, lived lives of rapacious irresponsibility. Her father spent his life trying to keep the family's money out of her husband's hands and out of her hands, because they were just wild. And they blew it very quickly. They were in debt.
They played craps on the floor.
They played craps on the floor. They were in debt their whole lives. He never developed a taste for work. She cobbled together things, all the time. My uncle remembers that when times used to get rough and there wasn't any money, and there never was, and times were always rough and things were always strapped, she would put on her best, what was left of the jewelry that hadn't been hawked and put on her best clothes. And because she had this kind of aristocratic bearing and this cachet, she would go to make the rounds for about 72 hours straight of all the private clubs in the Philadelphia area and sweep it up at the medium stakes bridge tables while drinking martinis and smoking, and she would come home with rent. And that's how they lived, you know, which was a huge fall from the debutante balls and sailing clubs that she had been part of in her youth. And she tells that story in this book, sort of with this great bohemian joie de vivre, but underneath it all is also what you sort of see seeping along the edges, the alcoholism, the sad marriage, the fall from grace, the struggle to maintain some sort of dignity, and at the same time, her constantly being the center of every party that she ever threw and being beloved by everyone who knew her.
And the comfort taken from food and serving other people food and feeling that sense of family.
Yeah, and not being the first or last woman in the history of feminine hardship to take refuge in the kitchen, whether it be eating or serving, and a true, and also I think an artistic sensibility. I mean, you can tell by the little bit that I read, she was literate, she was witty, and she was strapped and constrained. And I think that the kitchen became sort of a palette for her to express a cramped sensibility.
So you didn't know her.
I didn't know her. I knew her husband well because he lived to be 99. I knew him until I was in high school.
Oh, okay.
And he remarried, and after her, she died too young. She died at the age of 58 from the alcoholism that permeates the story. Mm-hmm. You know, in addition to sort of all the partying that's going on, you do get the sense that the party went on for 25 years, and never stopped, and it did her in. And there were times when I said she lived in worse abodes than an unheated shack. She went to mental hospitals to dry out because they didn't know how to dry people out otherwise in those days. So there were these sort of sad episodes, but none of that. You don't really get that tragic voice.
Doesn't sell newspapers.
Yeah, and this was before. Now she would write a great memoir about that, but there I think she was kind of trying to keep that on the down low.
So you didn't know her, but she cast a real, a light shadow over your family.
Yeah.
And she was legendary in your family, right?
Yeah. People can't talk about, people who knew her, which are still all her surviving grandchildren now in their 70s, they still can't even talk about her without tearing up. My Uncle Nick can barely mention her name.
In your family, you would call her?
Gima. Yeah. Right. Because there was just this, you know, there are people who leave a family and there's just this vortex that's left in their place. And he actually ended up naming his daughter after her because he said, I hoped that if I named my daughter Margaret, then maybe I would stop dreaming about Gima, but I still dream about her. Mm-hmm. She was just this vivid person. My father remembers Christmas began when she walked in the room. You know, I feel like everybody that I spoke to about her said essentially the same thing. The light went on when she walked into the room. And when she left, nobody ever replaced it.
She knew how to throw a party.
And she invited everybody.
Yeah, yeah. to what you were saying, one of the sort of more touching moments in the book is when she discovers this exotic dish called pizza. And it's, and you know, to a degree, it reminds you that you're reading an old cookbook because it's, you know, she says, there's something I've found. It is called Italian tomato pie.
Or pizza.
Yeah, exactly. But it's couched in the story about how she's pregnant with her second child. And I guess her mom thought
it was too disgraceful.
Right.
She'd married too young. She had married below her. And she got pregnant twice in 2 years, which just the WASPY family that she came from. There's a line where her mother said that they were looking through their heritage to see if anybody had peasant blood that would just continue these pregnancies. And one of the things she would do, and she was pregnant with my grandmother, who was another great light in our family, and she would go on these long walks while hugely and embarrassingly pregnant through the Italian neighborhoods of South Philadelphia. And here she is, this Chestnut Hill matron in 1919, walking through these Italian neighborhoods where her pregnancy was welcomed, you know, where everybody that she met was like, yay, a baby, you know, like just this very different world than her own world. And one of these, and it also shows her gift for insinuating herself into people's lives and befriending them. One of these Italian matrons took her inside and said, I have something that's good for you and for the, and as she relays, for the bambino, because it's important to keep those stereotypes solid. And this woman, and then she proceeds to say, she cut me a triangular piece of brownish red pastry called Italian tomato pie or pizza.
Yeah.
And you just get this kind of shiver that runs through you, like, she was the first wasp to eat pizza.
Yeah. And from this surrogate ethnic mother, basically,
yes, yeah,
that would accept her and not and not be mean to her.
And not judge her for what really seemed to be her sensuality, yeah, her, you know, this exhibition of whatever lust, whatever it was that had made her be in that embarrassing position twice in 2 years.
And then as you go through the book, you know, she casts aside the meringues and the green turtle soup, although green turtle soup comes up a lot in this book, actually. But, you know, the formality of that dinner, the food that she's cooking becomes much more earthy. It's certainly not afraid of ethnic food, which was indeed very exotic at the time that she was writing.
Yeah.
And you know, I won't say poverty food, but she wouldn't turn her nose up at anything. There's a great recipe in here on how to make your own scrapple, which I really recommend. as well as all of the what they call variety meats.
Yeah.
You know, the calf's brain in black butter is almost banal compared to some of the the, you know, the calf's head cheese and the eel.
During the war, they would it was when meat rations were on. She survived on eel on the Jersey Shore. And she says things like, you know, I love the fact that clearly she's addressing her book to respectable middle class housewives, because she'll speak in this sort of us voice where she'll say, but surely you have Jewish people who live in your neighborhood, and surely you have German immigrants, and surely there are Italians around.
Yeah.
Follow them
and
find out where they're getting their food, because they have better food than you do.
Yes.
You know, and I mean, I think the kind of cooking that she was espousing, any of us today would recommend, would recognize as Portland, Brooklyn food.
Exactly.
It's,
I mean,
like, it's heritage, artisanal food.
Even though she's like, oh my gosh, pizza. Do you know what I mean? There's something profoundly contemporary.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was, so the book came out in 1947.
Yeah.
Right, when we were just about to enter the huge phase of processed foods.
Yeah.
And yet there was still a generational memory of really cooking with hands, grabbing food out of the ground with hands, killing things, cutting them up, taking a calf's head, making it into cheese.
Fine summer snack, as she described it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, my mom used to love it. And preface this whole Julia Child sort of deformalizing of dinner. And at the same time, ultimately, I mean, she could be cooking in Dumbo, you know, with some of these.
She could have a food truck.
Right.
You know, she would. She would be a celebrity female butcher chef now if she were around. What I feel is the most poignant thing about the book is the sense that one gets of somebody writing out of time. You know, she is so much more of this moment than she was of the moment in which she was writing. And the plea that she is sort of crying out across the darkness of the post-war, you know, processed food generation that she's speaking to is like, you know, it's falling on deaf ears, you know, as she's saying, you know, because all of them are trying to get away from that. They're trying to get away from wartime rationing. They're trying to get away from the way their grandmothers cook. They want to be modern. They want to open up a can. It makes them cool to open up a can.
Right.
And she's saying, there's this thing called Parmesan cheese, and it doesn't come in a little green container. You can make your own chicken stock, and you know that people are like, well, make your own chicken.
That's what my mom used to do. So no, thank you.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that was when all of food culture, and indeed all of American culture, was trying to get rid of anything that reminded them of an agrarian or even European past.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
And there she was during the war thinking up, I mean, there's food rationing, there's a shortage. I mean, it's very poignant when she says things like, if you have butter, use butter for this recipe. Or if eggs aren't too expensive, try it this way. You know, by 47, she's still deeply aware of her own bankruptcy that was constantly hanging over them, in addition to the sort of general impoverishment of the country during the war. But, you know, she's also just this spirited, creative, bored, restless person who's on a farm in the eastern shore of Maryland right. and goes knocking door to door to every poultry farmer around and gathers coxcombs in a plastic bucket and takes them home and decides this is a great opportunity to learn how to make coxcombs, which I hear they eat in France, you know, and just whips it up and makes her guests have rooster horns
now,
for dinner.
Have you made the coxcombs?
I have. I don't even know. Well, this
see,
is,
I don't,
I'm sure
I've known you for a long time, and I think I've seen you make some oatmeal once. I don't think
oh
I've
my
even
God,
seen
you're
you
outing
self-make
me.
An onion sandwich in the kitchen.
But you've seen me roll craps in the hallway.
Oh, yes, I have. Yes, indeed. I have,
No, I'm usually more on the receiving end of the food.
Yeah.
And I
you
had
have a
the,
lovely husband.
I have a lovely. I had the good sense to marry a man who's a better cook than I am.
Yeah.
And who, as my friends say, you didn't marry a Brazilian man, you married an Italian woman, an yeah. old Italian woman who cooks long stews. So no, I mean, I present this book, honestly, more as a literary treasure than as a culinary one, although it's both.
Well, you ate a lot of this food last weekend in Frenchtown.
Oh, yes, last weekend.
Well, tell me about...
Buzz Market Frenchtown.
Yeah, of course. That's the crazy town that Liz owns in New Jersey. but before we get to that,
I would only own a crazy town.
John. What I mean, since you never met her, but you did eat her food growing up, like
yeah.
what are some of the recipes that survived into your childhood and beyond?
Well, see, here's the thing. She came from my dad's side of the family. My dad's side of the family is very careless with their treasures. There's a sort of strain of carelessness that runs through the Gilbert Potters. They're careless with their children. They're careless with their... They're just sort of like, But my mom's an Olson from Minnesota. She's a Swede. She married into this family, and she took their treasures very seriously, and the reason that we even have these books is because she preserved them. And I grew up eating food that my mother was cooking out of this book that I thought were her family recipes.
Yeah.
So when I read the book, I was like, what? Poor old mom's chutney? That's Grandma Olson's recipe, you know, but
right.
I didn't realize it was hers. The cinnamon buns that we eat every
Christmas. She just left those chutney gems lying about, and your mom picked them up.
That's right.
Passed them off as her own.
Well, I don't know if she was. I just assumed they were her own because I didn't think we had anything in my family on that side of the family. But she, so I had bread and butter.
I'm not
pickles,
calling your mother a liar.
We'll be discussing this afterwards. Braised celery, certain things that I just thought were Midwestern dishes that were hers. A lot of the preserves. My mom did a lot of food putting up when we were kids.
Right.
And most of it came from here, as it turned out.
And then last weekend in Frenchtown, the little Liz Gilbert fantasy town that you live in.
It's true.
You had a big event all weekend long where
yeah,
all
on
the
Liz
restaurants...
Yeah, on Main Street.
On Liz Street, yeah.
We had...
on Eat, Pray, Love Lane. Why is it the store? Why is just down Eat, Pray, Love Lane? Take a right at the Last American Man Street.
Oh,
no
my.
One goes down GQ Road anymore. A little inside Liz Gilbert humor.
You can park down at the Committed Culvert. We could do this all. I'm sorry.
No, I think that's about all we
I
can do.
I do own
actually.
A town in New Jersey. No, we have a. I live in this wonderful little town in New Jersey called Frenchtown, New Jersey, and we have a business there. My husband and I of importing. We have a pan Asian okay. emporium.
Let's just keep the advertising.
And
we're
going to buzz market that now. And we. I decided to do a signing of the cookbook at our store, and then I invited, we have 11 restaurants in our town, and all 11 of them all weekend did nothing but cook food from this cookbook, and all the little shops in town did cookies and hors d'oeuvres and lemonades and cocktails, and so you could walk through our little town and just eat my great-grandmother's food for one day, and it was really emotional for me because first of all her surviving grandchildren came, so it turned into a family reunion, and all of these people were eating food that they hadn't had since 1947. And they were having it in these wonderful little restaurants in our town, which is really sweet and moving. And also, a friend of mine came into the shop and told me that in Hindu mythology, I shouldn't say mythology, sorry, in Hindu... That myth called Hinduism. Oh, other people's religions are
in
so quaint.
In the crazy, wacky stories of the Hindustani.
And that silly old thing called Hinduism, they say, and it's adorable, they say that if you have a feast in the honor of a deceased loved one, you will ascend their soul rapidly through many levels of karma. And the fact that I know that my great-grandmother had a very sad death, that she was this great, buoyant woman with this tremendous curiosity and sense of adventure and invention, and that she was not, for whatever reasons, personal and political, I would say, of being a woman in her time, she was not given the opportunities that I wish she had been given in her life, and that 65 years after her book was initially published, this entire little town in New Jersey decided that everyone for one weekend would be cooking and eating her food. Just makes me feel like there's this
to bump up
somewhere
her karma.
She's just like she's been moved out of economy into first class. She's been given a big karmic upgrade.
So did you eat anything that you hadn't had in a long time, or that you'd never had before?
Yeah, I ate things that I'd never had before. I had the mulligatawny soup. She had mulligatawny soup in her recipe, which in her cookbook, which is pretty progressive. It's
a kind of green turtle soup.
That's made by superstitious Hindus.
So you tell
we'll just
a ghost,
keep that running.
You tell a ghost story over it, and somehow it turns into Indian.
Also, it was my dad's 70th birthday, and he is the 5-year-old child who she describes making a cinnamon roll in the shape of a bicycle for him one Christmas to present him with before he got the bicycle that he also got. And so his 70th birthday was this weekend, and so one of the bakeries in town prepared a cake from the recipe that he probably had for his 5th birthday cake. That was just very lovely, and it was heavier than the core of Jupiter. I don't know what they did in old-fashioned cakedom, but it was like it was just the densest but loveliest thing with a butter frosting that was very nice, and he was very happy, and he wept, as I might, if we continue on this vein. So we'll move to another topic.
Well,
it was very sweet.
She knew how to. I mean, there's a lot of generosity in her cooking. There's a whole chapter on what to bring for invalids, including beef tea, which is beef broth, basically, exactly as it sounds.
Yeah.
She also talks about making wine jelly, which I think is the she actually invented the Jell-O shot. Because I was reading it very carefully, and it's basically you make a gelatin, and then at the very end you add wine, and then you let it set up, and it's not at a point where the alcohol would have cooked off.
No.
So I think it's just sort of like how to sneak alcohol into a hospital.
Is what you're like. Yeah.
Now you know who is popularly credited with inventing the Jell-O shot.
Franklin Roosevelt.
No, that's good.
No, I don't know. I just.
that would be very good.
Took the edge off the war.
Yeah, no, exactly. Exactly. Tom Lehrer, the
really?
Satirical songwriter,
really?
is popularly credited with inventing the Jell-O shot. It
How
may
about
be
that?
Apocryphal.
How
but
about
I did
that?
Read
did
it on the internet.
Did he boil animals' hooves himself?
It was
to make
when
the
he
Jell-O?
Was, I think he was in the army, I think.
Interesting.
Or something. But she might have him beat on this.
I think, well, look, she was 20 years ahead of Julia Child. I think we could say that she was 30 years ahead of time.
She father. Also suggests holding parties for teenagers. The best thing for teenagers' parties is to give them waffles and bring a keg of beer. And then she says, and you'll be a part of the gang forever. Which is apparent is something I'm going to take very seriously.
My grandfather, all right, we'll keep this straight. Here's Gima. She had her daughter, who she was pregnant with when she ate the Italian.
Right. She
didn't tomato eat a, pie.
Right, she didn't eat an Italian.
She ate the Italian tomato pie. So her daughter, my grandmother, so my grandfather married into this family, and he married into that family. I asked him, and this was not related to this cookbook, years ago, I said, why did you marry my grandmother, Madeline? And he said, I wanted to spend more time with her mother.
Creepy.
I wanted to be in Mrs. Potter's kitchen all the time, and the best way to do it was to marry her daughter. Everybody wanted to be in her kitchen all the time. She talks about this one summer where they got a rental at a little cottage somewhere on the Delaware shore. They hired an aerial plane photographer to take a picture of the town. They made a postcard where they circled their house on the town, and that's all it said. And then on the back, it was printed, clam bake and beer every day at noon. Bring your own towels. And they and they sent this postcard to every single person they knew who knew that it was from them,
yeah,
and found them by carrying the postcard around the town and walking up the beach and arriving at the clam bake. That is hospitality beyond. That is just so amazing.
It's almost exhausting to contemplate. Clam bake and
beer. That's
how
you do a summer share.
Yeah, I know. Clam bake and beer at noon every day. And but then also to read how she would prepare for these hordes,
yeah,
of drunkards who would come to her house and just stay all day long and eat everything in sight. And
yeah,
it's really, I mean, I don't know how you do things in Frenchtown. You don't have visitors that often, I suppose. But, like, if you have visitors...
Oh, no, John. I have them all the time.
Oh.
I just...
How interesting.
Have been
I haven't
really
been
busy.
There for quite a while. I figured.
Go on.
But no, but she lays out
her
strategies,
sample menus? Yeah.
For making everything ahead of time so that you can actually enjoy yourself. And it, with military... I mean, poaching chicken with military precision.
Yeah.
It was really interesting to read.
And always making sure that the bottom of your icebox is filled with boiled potatoes. That was her emergency kit. Boiled potatoes, eggs, mayonnaise, and caviar. You can make something out
yeah
of that. And the other thing, it's not just inviting people. It's her husband, who was a barfly till the age of 99. I sat in bars in the 1980s with her husband when I was 15.
Eating waffles and drinking beer.
Eating waffles and yeah drinking kegs of beer.
Yeah.
And listening to new jazz records on the Victrola. And you know, he would go to bars, and he was incredibly social. He was very charming. He was very, very gregarious. And he would roll home when the bar closed with seven strangers who he convinced to come home because his wife would love to meet them, and she's a great cook and she would love to cook for you. And that's where she says one of her rules of hospitality is never make unexpected guests feel that they're in imposition, because half the time they're a little bit embarrassed themselves. You got the feeling that between the bar and waking up the housewife and turning on the kitchen light, the guests were like, maybe
yeah,
we,
appropriately.
You know,
they should have been feeling
we're
that
good
way.
Maybe we should, you know, and she's
yeah
like, no, I've got boiled potatoes and caviar. Let's roll some dice.
Why do you think she... I mean, but I would almost say, you know, I live a completely different style of life, which is make even welcome guests feel unwelcome.
Because they are.
Even people that you invited... Be like, yeah, maybe this isn't such a good idea, because...
My husband taught me a wonderful Brazilian trick that they say, you look at each other across the table and you say, I think our guests are tired. We should let them go home. It's a really good way to kick
people
out.
I almost went home. That was great. I almost got hypnotized.
No, I agree. I mean, you feel
Do you
a little
think
bit...
that she was just that generous of spirit, that she felt obliged by culture, or...
There's so much joy in the way she relays being a hostess mm-hmm that I don't want to pathologize it entirely. But I also do think, and I think you and I have known people like this, and I think I could say that my first marriage was sort of like this. There are couples who do best when there are a lot of people around.
Yeah.
And I think that she and Sheldon were the life of the party, and when the party stopped, it got very grim.
They're just
and
staring
so they
at
just
themselves
didn't stop
over a
the
bowl
party
of boiled potatoes.
Yeah, yeah, they just didn't stop the party. As long as there were, you know, a lot mm of other people in the room, and the Victrola was playing, and everybody was playing craps, and the cocktails were freely... I mean, she kept an
yeah
icebox long after electricity came, because she insisted on having cocktail ice, and the iceman coming into the kitchen with a block of ice for her cocktails.
And
every
I absolutely,
day.
Yeah, and I absolutely don't want to give the impression that it just seems totally tiring. I mean, there is so much in this book that really makes you want to go like, yeah, I want to try to make a tongue hash. Do you know what I mean? Or
yeah
prepare for an army of drunks to come to my house. There
yeah
is something that very inspiring about it and makes you want to try things. And indeed, you know, I found the last chapter where she gives really good advice about what to buy for your kitchen.
Yeah.
That just holds up the test of time completely, with the one exception... Her strong advice that you do not get an electric refrigerator, but keep an ice box.
Right.
And it was so tempting. I almost thought, yeah, I should get an ice box.
She's very convincing.
It is almost very convincing.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, you can't do that anymore.
But
I mean,
do you remember why she said she mourned the end of the ice box? It's because she mourned the end of the Iceman's visit, I think she had this craving to be around people all the
time. Right.
And what she missed when electricity came was the Iceman coming every day with his muddy boots, neighborhood gossip, and air of sex appeal.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you see a young Marlon Brando with, like,
sure,
you know, in his shirt sleeves with a big sling of ice overshadowing. Yeah. I don't even know, with the things from the horror movies.
I mean, it's real. The advice she gives about how to season a cast iron pan is spot on, and why that's all you need, and how to you know, if you don't have a lot of money to get fancy things, don't bother.
Yeah, like, nobody can tell the difference between shallots and onions when it's cooked.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's all really perfect advice, and particularly in that chapter, you get a sense that she feels really at home.
Yeah.
After this opening chapter of essentially her home falling down around her, and then the succession of country homes where the farmer neighbors are looking at them funny because they're drinking a cocktail at 7 instead of going to bed. Yeah. You know what I mean? And her trying to convince teenagers to like her with beer and stuff. Like, there is that moment where she's really at home.
Yeah.
So apart from getting an icebox, which I presume you don't have, and since you refuse to self-make yourself an onion sandwich, going through the process of rediscovering this book, is there any advice you do take from it?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's interesting because I confess that I didn't try the recipes before. I got so excited by her as a writer and as a historical figure that I...
But she's giving advice on more things than just
she is.
How to make kidneys and tomato
she
jelly
is.
Molds.
And I think it's funny because all the proceeds for this book are going to this wonderful organization that it helps send kids from under-resourced backgrounds to college. And
please stop buzz-marketing this charity.
I know. I'm sorry. Blah, blah, charity. But it's a really good charity, and I feel like she would have loved that. And there are, as of the last count, 23 kids who are going to be able to start college in the fall because of this book. I was being interviewed by somebody who said, what advice do you think she would have given to these young people? And I just thought, her life was so replete with irresponsibility that I'm trying to think whether you would want Kima giving advice to young people. But on the other hand, the big-heartedness, you know, the fact, how many people can you name in your life who 65 years after their death still bring tears to the eyes of anybody who remembered them? Like, that tremendous generosity and vivacity. I feel like the living of the life. And the story that I thought of when that question was asked was a story that I was only recently learned about her, which is that there was a point when she was young and she had just recently gotten married when a wealthy relative died and she was left a great sum of money and everybody told her to be wise with it and to buy a home or to put it away in the bank. And instead she took her best friend and they went to Paris for 3 months and they stayed at the St. George Hotel, which was the most expensive hotel in Paris at the time, and they spent every dime of it. They ate in the best restaurants. They went to all the nightclubs. I know that she hung out with movie stars, and this is Paris between the wars.
Sure.
You know,
Frenchtown, they called it then.
As it was known to its inhabitants. And she had this tremendous, like, high-octane experience of France and came home absolutely broke and was shamed by everybody in her family for having done this thing. And 2 weeks later, the stock market crashed and everybody was broke. And as she told it to my grandfather later, everybody else lost their money. I spent mine. And I feel like that's the spirit with which she lived her life, and she paid a cost for that. But at the same time, what a life. And there's moments where I read this book and I just think, we haven't had anyone this interesting in our family since then.
I disagree.
My dad's pretty interesting.
Your sister's
pretty interesting.
Maybe we should open the floor to some questions.
Go right ahead.
If anyone has any questions on any subject. Tom Lehrer, yes.
We will repeat your questions, so don't worry about it.
So make sure to whisper them soon.
I'm Jennifer. Hi,
Jennifer.
Read in the book reminded me a lot of a certain rhythm and humor of your writing. When you first started reading these pages, was there some kind of recognition or did something resonate about a certain heredity of that creative spirit?
Do you know, thank you. I'm honored to hear that. here's what I felt. I felt like I was listening to my sister, my sister's emails, my sister's writing. My sister's a writer as well.
I told you she was great.
I felt like I was listening to my grandmother Mimi's voice and her really brilliant letters. She just had this confidence with language. Her daughter, my grandmother. When I was a kid, I was on a train with her going through upstate New York, and we went through Poughkeepsie, and I was about 10 years old, and I was trying to spell it out, and I said, "Grandma, what does Poughkeepsie mean?" And she said, "Place where Vassar College is." It's an old Indian word. You know, like really fun, like that same kind of just very funny people, and I realized that there is possibly such a thing as a family voice, and that I had always thought my great-grandfather, Gima's husband, was a book collector, and he was very literary, and he was a sort of a literary snob, and he wrote these very ornate letters. And I always thought that the sort of writing strain in the family came from him, but she's the one who's the natural writer. You know, he was the one who was the sort of the formal writer, but she's the one who would want to get a postcard from. And now I see it in my sister's kids have sort of the same humor, the same voice, and I don't know how long you can carry on a family voice or how deeply it reached behind her, but without a doubt there's some sort of a living lineage that runs through there that's really an honor to be part of.
Hi, I'm Michelle. I just wanted to tag on to that question where I'm wondering, you know, from your sense of adventure to, you know, with the success of Eat, Pray, Love, do you see some of your great-grandmother's personality or just interests in you?
Not just in me, but in all her great-grandchildren. I mentioned that in the foreword, that it's almost like she fragmented, you know, and parts of her sort of got scattered into all of us. And my sister is an extraordinary hostess and a wonderful cook who you will see do more than make oatmeal when you go to her house, who's capable of any recipe in this book. My cousin Sarah lived in Europe for 7 years. It makes my adventures look very pale by comparison. There are four of us. My cousin Alexa is a historian at the National Archives, and my great-grandmother was a food historian as well as being a food lover and writes about the antique cookbooks that she collected and studied. So, like, you know, she kind of like reappears, almost like sending out shoots underground. You know, she kind of pops up in all of us in various ways. I certainly feel as though I've been entitled to, you know, I mean, the most obvious thing is that she left her husband at one point in the 30s and moved out on her own for a short while and had this dream to move to France and live with her uncle, who was a portrait painter there, who had been kicked out of polite Philadelphia society for having an affair with a married woman. And she adored him, and she was going to take her 16-year-old daughter, my grandmother, and move to Paris and start a new life. And her impossible husband, my great-grandfather, convinced her to come back to him, and she stayed with him until she drank herself to death, essentially. And so the obvious point of departure here is that I was the one who got to leave my unhappy marriage, go into another part of the world, eat my way back to health, you know, have this sort of decadent and delirious experience of the self and return home and recreate and renew. And that was an opportunity that she, for whatever reasons, was not allowed to do. So I feel lucky and saddened by that. Anybody else feeling lucky and sad? Margaret, as always. Go ahead and poke up questions, too. We don't need the mic.
Yeah, just raise your hand.
Did she publish other books?
She did not, but I do.
Question was, did she publish other books?
She didn't. And, you know, when I talk about the carelessness of my family, we don't even have her letters. My Uncle Nick said, oh, yeah, she used to write me letters all the time. And I'd be like, oh, what a great letter. You know, We you know, nobody held on to any of that stuff. What we do have is a scrapbook of all her food columns for the Delaware Star and the Philadelphia Inquirer, and those are really wonderful as well. A lot of that stuff went into this book.
How did she come to start writing for the newspaper?
I think she needed the money, and she mentions in here a friend who's a newspaper editor who she used to bring soup to when he was in the hospital, and I'm sure it was some sort of a family connection.
Brandy soup?
Brandy's. She invented brandy soup that now all the frat kids do.
One of the things I love about the book is that it sort of anticipates Brooklyn-style foodieism. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But it has none of the selfishness of contemporary Buddhism. Do you know what I mean?
No preciousness.
It's not, it's just that it's not precious. It's also, it's not self-celebratory or indulgent. Right. It is generous. I mean, perhaps to a fault.
Yeah.
But it's about making food for other people.
For other people, yeah.
Rather than, look at the thing I have on my plate right now. Click. Tweets. You know, like.
Or that kind of aggressive cooking where people are like, I fucking cooked this!
Yeah.
Nailed it! You know, like, it's like this abusive kind of pride in the cooking. Like, I don't think there's that in there. And I've wondered what she would think of this moment. And I think there are things about it that she would love. I think she would... a great deal of it she would love, and a great deal of it she was preaching. I was like, what would she think of veganism? You know, she has a vegetable soup recipe in this book. It's one of my favorite moments in the book. Vegetable soup for six. Step one, get 3 pounds of beef. That's it too. And it's not ironic. Like,
yeah.
I'm like, yeah, we don't call that vegetable soup anymore. But that's now, I guess it's vegetable soup because there were vegetables in it.
Right.
In addition to, and we made that vegetable soup the other day, by the way, and it was stupid. Tremendous, and very beefy and delicious.
Just don't tell your vegetarian friends. They'll love it.
Yes. It's so good. But I think she would have, I think she would have treated vegans the same way she treats teetotalers and the ill in this book, which is that you work around them and you find something they can digest. If somebody comes to your house who's not drinking, you make them a wonderful, sparkling, soft drink. And if
a horse's neck is what she recommends.
It is, indeed.
Horse's neck.
She would have accommodated, I think, anything that came into her house without making the person feel freakish. Well, food allergies are not mentioned in this cookbook either.
Yes.
I was wondering how you, as a writer, sort of attack projects that aren't specifically in the writer path, and what this sort of project has made you feel in terms of working outside the box of where everybody expects you to be.
Well, it's kind of, this one woman said to me, so I heard about this, and I was like, oh, all right, I get it. First you go have this great adventure, and you travel all over the world, and you get all liberated. Then your next book's about marriage. Then you write a fucking cookbook. You know, and it was just, and I was like, hey, lady, easy on the F-bombs in the library, first of all, I said to her. I said, Mom, I'll write the books I want to write, Mom. No, So I see your point that it is unlikely. And you know what? I did have, when I first discovered it, I really did get sort of shot through. You know, like a lot of creativity is about kind of walking through life with the divining rod, right? And you wait for the jolt of something to excite you and send a shock up your arm and tell you that you should be doing this. And when I first encountered this book, I'm so deeply involved in this novel that I've been researching for 3 years that I just started writing a few months ago. And I just almost felt derailed when I found this because I thought, it just had such a weight and it had such an impact. And I wondered, oh, wait a minute, am I supposed to write a book about this, and should I be cooking all these recipes, and then should I go and do a sort of a history of mid-century American women, and should I could sort of picture everything I could do with this, go back and read all those columns, find all the places where she used to live, like just track, it could be a cool book. But the reality is I'm not a cook. I am a grateful and shameless eater. But I'm not a cook, and I just felt like I couldn't have honored it in the right way. And also, there's something else I'm supposed to be doing right now. And so the answer was to bring the book forth, and just to present it rather than to write about it. And I also sort of feel like enough with the memoirs for a while. So instead, I'm working on my big gardening epic novel. But it was a delightful. It's been an act of fierce stewardship to bring her voice back into the world at this moment, where I feel like it will be so much more appreciated than it was the first time. And the slogan that I keep telling people is, "Don't make the mistake your grandmother made. Read this book." This is her second chance to find her audience, and it's delightful to go bang a drum about it.
Ladies and gentlemen, Liz Gilbert.
Ladies and gentlemen, John Hatchman.
The book is called At Home on the Range. Liz, you're going to hang around and sign it.
I will.
The charity is called Scholar Match. The town is called Frenchtown.
Is there anything else you want to plug?
It's such a delight to hang out with you anytime.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. And thank you, Paul, very much for the wonderful introduction to the New York
Public
Library.
Thank you, everybody, for coming and being part of this.
And, I didn't see you guys there. Thank you. So nice of you guys to come. Thank you very much.